Though the undertaker clearly disapproved, they toted Uncle Camp into Aunt Loma's little parlor as if he had a right to be there. I followed close behind Grandpa, who told me to come in and close the sliding double doors. Mr. Birdsong unfolded his new collapsible casket stand and set it up right in front of the white mantelpiece that Uncle Camp had painted. I don't know why, but I walked over to see if the button, the pencil, and the cockroach were still there. They were, of course, just same as Granny's death was still in the toy Bible. Loma had hung the St. Cecilia at the organ mirror above the mantel. I watched in it as the boys lifted the casket onto the stand and Mr. Birdsong laid a big wreath of wax flowers on top, about where Uncle Camp's hands that held the pistol would now be pressed together in prayer. Mr. Birdsong always arranged dead hands like in prayer. Hitching his trousers with his arm stub, Grandpa looked around and said, "Get that marble-top table over yonder, Will Tweedy, and set it by the head of that coffin. Then see can you find a kerosene lamp to put on it." He must have thought the carbon bulb hanging from the ceiling was too raw-looking for setting up. "Grandpa, you ain't gonna open the coffin, are you, sir?" "No, course not. Camp ain't in no condition for viewing." He spoke calm, but went to scratching his head like he had the itch. "Where's Loma at, and your daddy and mother?" "They all upstairs in the bedroom," I said. "Aunt Loma's still like she was at the depot. She don't even know what's going on. Grandpa, I thought you didn't like embalming and funerals and all." "I don't, but I don't like hypocrites neither. I can't stop folks from judging Camp, but I ain't a-going to let him say how he's got to be buried. Where's Miss Love at?"
"In the kitchen."
"Go get her for me."
"Yes, sir."
"And bring a lamp."
"Yes, sir."
Wading through the crowd of silent people in the front hall, I found Miss Love busy getting out dishes. She knew Grandpa had brought Uncle Camp home. When she saw me at the kitchen door, she said, "Loma should be in there when people start paying their respects."
"You think anybody will go in, Miss Love?"
"Yes, because your grandfather will get his revolver if they don't." Turning to look at me as she reached for some dishes on a high shelf, Miss Love almost smiled. "But he won't have to, of course. Even grown people mind Mr. Blakesley will, as if they had no choice." I couldn't help wondering had she minded him. Let him have his way with her, as the saying goes. I took a stack of plates out of her hands and set them on the kitchen table by a pile of papers that I recognized as copies of Loma's Christmas play. I reached for the lamp at the back of the table where Loma had left it last time the lights went out. I felt awful. "Ma'am, do you think Uncle Camp might still be alive if Loma and Grandpa hadn't blessed him out so much? You think Grandpa's trying to make it up to him now?" I struck a match and put it to the lamp wick.
"Shh, Will. We'll never know. Not even your grandfather will know, because he won't let himself think that way."
"And couldn't admit it if he did?"
"And couldn't admit it if he did."
"Aunt Loma was the main one, I reckon, but she won't ever see how she treated him." In a low, miserable voice, I said, "Miss Love, I didn't treat him so good myself."
"We'll talk about it later, Will. Not now."
Miss Love took off her apron. I picked up the lamp and we hurried out. Mr. Birdsong and his boys were just leaving. I watched them walk across the gold cat paw prints on the dining room floor and go out through the kitchen. Then we went on in the parlor, and Miss Love asked Grandpa if she should go get Loma and Mr. Hoyt and Mary Willis.
"I want you here by me where you belong to be," said Grandpa. "Let Will Tweedy go. Tell your daddy to bring Loma on down, son. But first open them doors. It won't do to keep folks a-waiting. They might leave."
As he took a hold of Miss Love's elbow, I pushed open the double doors, and he stood glaring at the silent, uneasy crowd.
"Y'all can come on in now," he said, as if it never occurred to him they might not want to.
All those cold, sassy eyes moved past Grandpa and Miss Love and focused on the coffin, but nobody moved.
"Craddock," Grandpa spoke in a soft voice, "you and Miss Flournoy come first. Camp always thought a lot of y'all."
Mr. Flournoy came forward like a puppet on a string. Miss Love held out her hand to him. As Mr. Flournoy took it, he turned and looked back at his wife.
"Mama," he whispered. She looked nervous and uncertain, as if being in the same room with the suicide corpse might taint her. But she came on in, and Mr. Flournoy ushered her forward. I watched the Flournoys stare at the coffin.
I knew they were wondering if Mr. Birdsong had been able to make Uncle Camp look natural, considering the circumstances. But then Mrs. Flournoy commenced crying.
"Daddy," she sobbed, "we could have been nicer to that poor boy."
One by one, then in groups, Cold Sassy came in to view the hidden remains. Watching them file by, I felt like their tears weren't just from gruesome imaginings of the blasted head under the golden oak coffin lid. They cried from real sorrow. Like me and Mrs. Flournoy, they knew they could have been nicer. Hurrying out to go upstairs, I was surprised to see Grandpa following behind.
"It's all right in the parlor now, son. I'd best see after Loma myself."
As we pushed our way through the hall toward the stairs, I heard somebody ask where was the poor fatherless child. Somebody else said the baby was over at the Tweedies. "The cook's keeping him." Papa was kneeling by the window praying. Mama sat on the foot of the bed holding a wet wash rag to her forehead. Aunt Loma, still in the dressy black wool outfit she'd worn to Sue Lee's, she walked the floor in front of the bureau, back and forth, forth and back. She didn't cry or carry on. She looked like a sleepwalker. Back and forth, and I don't believe she knew where she was or even that she paced.
"Loma," Grandpa stood in the door, "I brung Camp's body home."
My parents looked up surprised, but Loma just kept pacing. He spoke louder.
"Loma, I brung Camp's body home, and folks are down there paying their respects. They'll want to say their condolences to you."
She kept walking, back and forth, forth and back. Mama got up from the bed and put her hand on Loma's arm.
"Sugar, here's Pa," she said softly.
"You all go on down to the parlor," Grandpa told us. As we filed out, he was saying, "Loma, come here to your daddy, pet."
I glanced back just as he caught her arm and pulled her to him. She looked slowly up to see who had her. Then her eyes focused and tears ran down her cheeks. Clutching her arms around her daddy's waist, she hid her face against his chest.
"Oh, Pa," she cried. "Oh, Pa, I've been so mean to him. I fussed so about the faucet."
She sounded like somebody lost.
"Pa, I want to come home. Can I? Me and the baby. Please?"
I didn't hear if he said yes or no because I had to shut the door. But as I followed Mama and Papa down the stairs, I wondered would he let her? And would Miss Love let her? If she and Grandpa were romancing, it sure would put a crimp in things to have jealousy incarnate underfoot. I couldn't help thinking that if all Grandpa needed was a housekeeper, Aunt Loma could keep house for him now. But even if he hadn't wanted Miss Love, it was just as well he didn't wait for Loma. If she'd been born colored, not a soul would have hired her to clean up or cook either one. Anyhow, Grandpa hadn't hardly passed the time of day with Loma since they quarreled about her being an actress, and things got even worse between them after she disobeyed him and married Uncle Camp. When Campbell Jr. was born, he did go see the baby and made a big to-do over it being a boy, which really pleased Aunt Loma. But that was the end of that. It didn't really change anything. Whenever the two of them were in the same room, it was like they didn't know enough English to carry on a conversation. They both could hold a grudge like it was a life work. Well, it was awful to think what it had taken to make Grandpa treat Loma and Uncle Camp nice. There hadn't been a suicide in Cold Sassy since the Crabtree's son Arthur got drunk on a cold winter night, lay down across his sweetheart's grave, and took an overdose of laudanum. Next morning when he was found, the bottle was laying by his body. Arthur never even got back home. The Crabtrees were so mad and hurt and ashamed, they took a pine casket out to the cemetery and put him right under, and to this day there isn't a marker on his grave. The burial service was just one sentence. The preacher said, "God won't forgive this awful thing he did." Dr. Slaughter thought it wasn't the laudanum that killed Arthur. It was laying out there all night in 20-degree weather. But he was considered a suicide person just the same, since suicide was his clear intent. 2 months before, when Arthur's 16-year-old sweetheart died of galloping consumption, the Cold Sassy Weekly had called her passing the saddest and yet most beautiful death in memory, lamented in verse by her brother James, well-known invalid poet of Maysville, Georgia. The paper printed Brother James's whole long Dern memorial poem about her. But poor Arthur just got two lines. Young Arthur Crabtree of this city became deceased last Thursday. Camp would have gone the same way as Arthur if it had been left up to his folks. The Williamses, I mean. Grandpa sent word to them right after it happened, but they sent word back saying they wouldn't come. That was the whole message. Despite Camp wrote in his letter that he wanted to be buried in Cold Sassy, Mama had hoped the Williamses would say, "Bring our boy home." That was the usual thing to do when a young person died. "It would have saved a lot of embarrassment for Loma, considering," said Mama, "not to mention the rest of the family." But if Mama or Cold Sassy thought Campbell Williams would end up with a quick private burying like Arthur Crabtree's, it had another think coming. One day at 3 o'clock, Camp had him a nice, long, regular-type funeral in the Baptist church. Brother Beli Jones didn't give any eulogy, but he asked God to comfort the young widow and raise the baby in the bosom of the Lamb, and then he read scriptures for an hour. As the preacher finished the 23rd Psalm, he looked at Grandpa with a question mark on his face. Grandpa, who sat between Aunt Loma and Miss Love, glared hard at Brother Jones, and the preacher said, "Let us bow our heads again in prayer." After reminding God that in the note to his wife the deceased had asked his forgiveness, Brother Jones prayed, "Lord, thou knowest this congregation is shocked and saddened by what has happened in our community. We know the Bible says it is a sin to take life, our own as much as anybody else's. But, Lord, help us to see that this boy was a poor lost soul and deserving of our compassion." Grandpa nodded grimly, and the funeral was over. Nobody was sure that Camp's asking God's forgiveness before he pulled the trigger counted as much as if he had lived long enough to repent after doing the deed, but it was a comfort and hope. No suicide person in living memory had ever been treated nice as Uncle Camp. Papa even wondered if maybe Grandpa gave some money to the Baptist church to get it done right, but Mama said that idea was far-fetched, stingy as Pa is. Anyhow, it was a grand send-off. And as if the church funeral and the fine coffin weren't enough, Grandpa not only insisted Camp be laid to rest in the toy plot, but had Loomis dig the grave right at Miss Mattie Lou's feet. There were those who thought it was gone far too far to put somebody who was already halfway to hell at the feet of a lady who'd been a saint on earth if ever there was one. But Grandpa didn't ask anybody's permission. Later that evening, when we were all at Aunt Loma's to eat supper, I asked him if he thought Uncle Camp could have got to hell already. Grandpa told me to shut up. "There's plenty of men that are mean and hateful, son, or they cheat folks, or beat their wives and they're colored, but when they die, them preachers can't say enough nice things." Well, Camp, he wasn't evil or hateful, either one. He just couldn't do nothing. So doggett, Wilt Tweedy, ain't you or nobody else gonna say he's gone to hell. He just couldn't stand it no more. Would a loving God kick a boy unhappy enough to do what poor Camp did? Mama came up while Grandpa was talking. Right in front of her, he said he didn't want no funeral when he died. "I want a party like them Irishmen have." It made me proud how Grandpa was that day. But if I'd known from the beginning that Aunt Loma and Campbell Jr. would come live with us instead of with him and Miss Love, and me have to give up my room and sleep winter and summer on a sawed-off old bed out on our back porch, I'd have been too mad at Uncle Camp to fix the faucet for him. Chapter 45. It would have made a lot more sense for Loma to go live with her daddy and Miss Love. She and Campbell Jr. could have had the upstairs room that was hers growing up. Doing her duty, Miss Love gave her an invite the day after the funeral, but Grandpa spoke up before Loma could open her mouth. "No, you better go live with Sister and Hoyt," he said. "I'm too old to help raise a young'un." Despite Loma had begged him to come home, I don't doubt she was relieved not to be gone. Besides how she felt about Miss Love, there was how she felt about kerosene lamps, well water, and privies. Still and all, I don't see why she couldn't just stay on where she was and said so. "For pity's sake, Will," said Mama, "I never thought to raise a boy so hard-hearted. What families are for is to help one another in time of trouble." "Well'm, but it ain't like Aunt Loma's homeless." "She can't stay where she is, not unless some older woman could go live with her, and I don't know who that would be. A widow pretty as Loma, not but 21 years old, what would people say? And how would she live? Lord knows there's nothing under her mattress to fall back on." What she would fall back on was Grandpa, of course.
and since he owned her house as well as ours, it hadn't taken him 2 minutes to see that by putting two families together and leasing out Loma's place, the rent money would just about equal her upkeep. I know Aunt Loma didn't mind coming to our house a bit. She cried when Papa said she could bring only one cat, but losing the cats was nothing compared to gaining Queenie, who would help with the baby and do their washing and cook their food. Aunt Loma was a lot of things, but not dumb. The first week or two at our house, she stayed in her room, my room, crying about treating poor Camp so mean, but it wasn't long till she was mourning instead for the way he had treated her. During the Christmas holidays, I went up to her room, my room, to see could I find my tobacco tags. I thought I had them in a Prince Albert can under a loose board near the fireplace in there. The door was open, so I went in, and there stood Aunt Loma in front of the mirror, staring at herself in the thin flowered dress Miss Love brought her from New York, the one she couldn't wear last summer because of being in mourning for Granny, and couldn't wear next summer on account of being a widow. Seeing me in the glass coming up behind her, she jerked around and started yelling about Uncle Camp killing himself. "The nerve of him leaving me like this! Beholden to my daddy and my brother-in-law for the very clothes on my back and the food in my mouth." "Oh, Aunt Loma, you don't have to feel beholden," I said, honestly trying to be a comfort. "Mama says that's what families are for." Whereat she collapsed on the bed and went to crying. "Oh, Will, what's to become of me?" As Aunt Loma got used to Camp being gone, though, she seemed to take on new life, and despite it was crowded at our house, we all settled down. She and I had a run-in every now and again, but even Aunt Loma could see it was to her advantage to be nice. Except for nursing the baby, she was more or less free to hold him or put him down, same as if she was his grandmother or maiden aunt. She never had to look after him unless she was in a mood to, because if he wasn't toddling around after me, he was with Mary Toy, unless he was with Mama or Queenie. Life was just easier now for Aunt Loma. Well, it wasn't easier for me. As always, when things got behind in the family or at the store, I was the one who took up the slack. I never saw Pink and Leroy and Smiley except at school or church. I kept thinking I'd drive the Cadillac out toward Milltown and see could I find Lightfoot McClendon and take her to ride, but I never got to. I finally asked Mama why couldn't Aunt Loma make herself more useful. That way I might could play baseball every year or two with Pink and them or go fishing sometime. Mama was at the sink washing sweet potatoes to bake for supper. She said, not unkindly, "Don't talk bitter, Will. Loma's gone through a bad time." "Yes, and but it sure would help if she could milk the cow and bring in stove wood." Mama bristled. "Yankee women do work like that, and colored women and tenant farmers' wives and daughters. We don't. Loma helps in the house, and that's enough." Loma mostly stayed up in her room, my room, and did what she'd always wanted to, namely write poems and plays. But pretending to be a writer wasn't much fun without an audience, so pretty soon she brought her pencil and paper down to the breakfast table. Once when the muse was on her, she sat staring into space so long I got worried. "Reckon Aunt Loma's had a stroke?" I whispered to Queenie. "No, sir, Mr. Will," she whispered back. "Miss Loma just be citing on a poem. She does like that lots of time." But it was easy to see the widow was restless, and before long she waylaid Grandpa, when he stopped by for his snort, to ask if she could come work at the store. He said he'd think on it. Lord knows he needed somebody, what with Miss Love gone to housekeeping, Uncle Camp gone to hell, and spring just around the corner. Farmers would soon be coming in to arrange credit terms and buy seed and guano. Ladies were already picking through patterns and piece goods, planning their Easter dresses. And it looked like everybody and his brother was itching for an automobile. On a warm Saturday, we could hardly wait on customers for taking folks to ride. On the other hand, we couldn't afford to put them off because the cars were beginning to sell. Grandpa read in the paper that in 1906 there were at least 1,000 automobiles in Georgia, mostly owned by farmers, doctors, and residents of small towns. That really fired him up to try to sell a lot in 1907. In the meantime, I was still the stable boy for Miss Love and Grandpa. I never had time to talk much when I went up there, but I couldn't help noticing she seemed happier lately, and that was a relief. Ever since that night at Miss Gussie's house, I'd been scared we'd hear any day that she was leaving for Baltimore. Or Texas. I do remember complaining to her about the committee that had been set up to find a more modern name for Cold Sassy. "Papa's in favor," I grumped. "I don't see why he ain't noticed that the reason it's called Cold Sassy is because that's its name." "Don't worry so, Will," said Miss Love, smiling her big mouth smile. "You know your grandfather will never let it happen."
Miss Love was washing a kitchen window that looked clean to me already. It seemed like every time I went down there she was washing floors or windows, one, despite she'd cleaned the whole house good last summer. "Miss Love, I reckon you ain't heard about fall and spring cleaning," I said one day. She had come out on the back porch to empty her washwater just as I headed for the barn. I said, "In between spring and fall, and fall and spring, ma'am, you just supposed to sweep and mop and use the feather dusting like that." "I like the Yankee way better," she said, bristling. I reckon she thought Mama had criticized how she did. "Up north, ladies do extra cleaning every week in one room. Brush down the walls and wash the floor one week, maybe wash windows and curtains the next, and so on. When they get that room done, they start on another. The house stays nice year-round, and it's not exhausting like doing all the heavy cleaning at once." When I told Mama, she said, "I'd rather get worn out twice a year than stay worn out all the time." The Rucker Blakesley Hotel sign was finally up, and they said Mr. Clem Crummy just about got apoplexy every time a stranger asked was the hotel owned by the same fella had the brick store up the street. I knew Miss Love thought it was awful of Grandpa to hold Mr. Clem to the drawin', but he just laughed when she said so. Then one day she came down to the store with a sign she had made. Grandpa read it and laughed. "Go on, put it in the window," he said. This is what was on it. "Attention, drummers, cotton buyers, railroad men, and other travelers. Try the elegant, refurbished Blakesley Hotel. Fine cuisine, clean, bug-free beds, fiddle music and parlor games every night." The Crummies never even said thank you, but the sign got them some business that usually went to the boarding houses. Miss Love's birthday was on Valentine's. That's how come she was named Love. The day before, Grandpa told me she had decided to give herself a present. She was going to use some of her savings to put in a bathroom and, of course, a sink and faucet in the kitchen. "It's folderol and foolishment," he said, but he grinned proud. That told me one thing. Whether Miss Love was now Grandpa's wife or still just his housekeeper, she wouldn't put her own money into plumbing if she was still thinking about leaving Cold Sassy. On the other hand, she had another think coming if she expected Grandpa to say, "Don't spend your money, let me give you the bathroom for your birthday." He had already bought her a present, a home graphophone. It cost $5 from the talking machine department at Sears Roebuck and Company, and he'd ordered a dozen best and loudest music records to play on it. A machine that could talk and play music was, as Grandpa kept saying, a dang marvel. You can imagine that when Cold Sassy heard about the graphophone, everybody remembered he never gave Miss Mattie Lou a birthday present. Granny had always insisted she didn't want one. "Birthdays is for children," she'd say. "I don't have to mock getting older. I can just look in the glass and tell." He did order Granny a coconut and a crate of oranges every Christmas to make him some ambrosia with, but his Christmas gift to Miss Love had been a new buggy top with side and back curtains, and now not 2 months later he bought her that graphophone. From Valentine's Day on, Grandpa never went back to the store after dinner on Wednesdays. Like I said, the stores in Cold Sassy closed every Wednesday around noon, but always before he went back to work anyway. Said it was a good chance to catch up on what needed doing. But now it looked like he was catching up on Miss Love. Sometimes they'd go buggy riding, closed up snug with the side and back curtains snapped shut. One freezing cold Wednesday I went through the house on my way to the barn and found them sitting in the warm kitchen, him in a rocking chair with his glasses on, reading to Miss Love while she sewed. One Sunday after dinner I went up there just to visit a while, and Grandpa was laying on the daybed in the hall, with Miss Love sitting right on the bed beside him rubbing his forehead. When they saw me, she jumped like somebody caught stealing and hurried to the kitchen, and he sat up muttering something about a backache. Plain as day, Grandpa was courting Miss Love. Why else would he be home with her so much? Why else would he have spent so much on the graphophone and the records for it? Despite I couldn't know if they still called each other Miss and Mister when it was just the two of them, I sensed a difference lately. They were always laughing and teasing, and whenever one came in a room where the other one was, you could read a book by the light on their faces. To me, they were like a book with the last chapter missing, and I couldn't wait to know how it ended. At school, when we commenced studying Romeo and Juliet, the drama that might or might not be going on up at Grandpa's house laid itself down on every line Shakespeare wrote about love or marriage. "Does she call him husband?" I read, and thought of Miss Love, not Juliet. "Stony limits cannot hold love out." That was Grandpa shouting at his love. "Oh, I have bought the mansion of a love, but not possessed it," was his lament. But hark,
Mayhap Miss Love doth use Juliet's words to tease. If thou think'st I am too quickly won, I'll frown and be perverse and say thee nay, so thou wilt woo. Well, Grandpa was wooing, no doubt about it, and seemed like Miss Love was enjoying being wooed. But was she yet saying him nay? Whenever I was up at their house, I'd go to wondering if she still slept in the spare room by herself, or did he come in there sometimes at night, or had she taken over Granny's side of his bed? It wasn't decent the way I kept picturing in my mind what might or might not be going on, and none of it any of my business. I just wished I knew one way or the other. Then maybe I could quit wondering, and, as Papa would say, behave myself. One night I had to go take Grandpa a message from my daddy. As I ran up the front steps, I noticed the parlor draperies were pulled too. And despite the house was shut up tight, I could hear the music machine just a-going. Hurrying in, I saw they'd pushed all the parlor furniture back against the walls. Miss Love had put on a new dance record, and by golly, she was teaching Grandpa the turkey trot. He was bad to stumble and kept stepping on her feet, but they were laughing and cutting up, just having the best time. I stood there grinning, and they waved at me. "I'm getting the hang of it, Will Tweedy," bragged Grandpa, swinging her around. "Next time we go to New York City, I ain't going to have to pay no partner for her. Here, Love, learn Will Tweedy how," he said, handing her over to me. "I got to rest a spell." I was as stumbly as Grandpa and kept stepping on her feet, too. But boy, howdy, I had my arms around her, and she was looking up at me, smiling, while Grandpa watched us and beat time to the music. When the machine started winding down, making funny groans and whines, we all three laughed like children. Later, I couldn't help but try and imagine what it would be like dancing with Lightfoot McClendon. In my mind, I saw her in a silk ball gown, smiling up at me as I held her, and us circling and whirling. I still thought about Lightfoot a lot and still wondered sometimes if she hated me for kissing her. But I was too busy to moon over it much. Things had got real bad at the store. Aunt Loma kept pestering Grandpa for a job. He didn't pay her any mind, but he did start saying he had to hire somebody. One morning before school, I was stacking big sacks of cow feed and guano outside against the brick wall of the store when Grandpa ambled out, spat brown tobacco juice through a crack in the board sidewalk, and said, "Will Tweedy, you know the mill boy that come in here a while back wanting a job? What's his name, son?" I knew right off who and what he had in mind, and it made me mad as heck. But all I said was, "Hosey Roach? That's the one. Is he in school this term?" "Yes, sir." "How old you reckon Hosey is? He ain't a real big boy, as I recollect, but he's some older than you, ain't he?" "Yes, sir. He's probably 20, maybe 21. I couldn't help adding, "And still ain't finished school." "Well, he seemed right smart to me." Grandpa had sense enough to know the reason Hosey hadn't graduated was that he worked a lot at the cotton mill and couldn't get to school regular. "I like that boy. Tell him to come see me this evening, son. I got to get me some more help." I told Hosey what Grandpa said. He didn't jump up and down about it like I thought he would, didn't even let on he was excited. But he couldn't hide the deep flush that came on his face. "Tell Mr. Blakesley I can't come today," he said, putting his scaly hands in the pockets of his dirty, ragged overalls. "Tell him I'll be by tomorrow." "He ain't gone like it, you not coming when he said to," I spoke hateful. "He's used to folks saying yes, sir, when he tells him something." Hosey flushed again. I swear he looked like my dog T.R. when he's ashamed and trying to wag his tail and drag his belly at the same time. "Well," said Hosey, "be sure and say I'll see him tomorrow, hear? Tell him I'll be by before school takes in." I fell in step with Grandpa next morning as he left our house after his snort. "I'm going by the store and get me a pencil," I said. Crossing North Main with T.R. trotting ahead, I decided to speak up about Hosey Roach. "They ain't but four things wrong with him, Grandpa." "What, son, besides he's a mill boy?" "Some folks in Cold Sassy will think when it comes to working at your store, him being a lint head is enough and too much." I was being real smart, Alec. "Main thing, sir, he's got cooties and the itch and he stinks."
"He was clean as you that day he come and asked him for a job."
"Well, he ain't clean when he comes to school. He don't grow much beard, but his hair's so long and tangled and dirty it looks like a darn cootie stable, ha!"
Hosey was waiting in front of the store when we got there. I didn't hardly recognize him. Naturally, he was barefooted and his feet were cracked and bleeding from the cold. But he had on new overalls and a clean long-sleeved denim shirt. His face was shaved smooth and scrubbed raw, the tow hair clean and wet-combed. I knew now why Hosey wouldn't stop by yesterday. He was too proud to show up dirty. He must have scrubbed himself from supper time to midnight.
"I'll come to see about the job, sir," he said as Grandpa unlocked the big door. "So I hope you ain't already hired somebody. Come on in, son."
I knew Grandpa was surprised at Hosey being so clean after what I said, but I could see it pleased him. While he went behind the counter to unlock the cash register, I walked over to the rack where the tablets and pencils were. But of course, all I really had on my mind was Hosey Roach. If he got hired, it wouldn't be Uncle Camp he'd be replacing. It'd be me. He'd get the floors swept and the stock put out every morning in no time. Within a week, he would find 100 ways to make himself useful. Without being asked, he'd get the chickens crated up to ship to Atlanta, and the cars washed, and I don't know what all. Lord, smart as Hosey was, it wouldn't be any time before he'd know how to drive and start taking people out for demonstration rides. And unless folks didn't want his hands on their foodstuff, he'd soon be weighing up sugar and flour and drawing molasses out of the barrel. Hosey wasn't any better worker than me, but whereas I always had to go home in time to milk and bring in stovewood, he could stay all night if Grandpa wanted him to. And whereas my daddy always asked how much Latin or geometry I had to do that night, and lots of times made me go home early to get at it, Hosey would of course quit school if he got the job. Bad as he wanted to leave the mill and amount to something, Hosey would be equal to 10 of Uncle Camp plus maybe 2 of me, and Grandpa would respect him. Jealousy rose in me like a pain as I heard them talking terms. Grandpa had sense enough to know how cheap a lint head would work. However little he paid, it would be more than Hosey made at the mill. He would cost more than me, since I didn't get paid anything, being in the family, but he would be cheaper than Uncle Camp, who had to be paid enough for him and Aunt Loma to live on. The whole idea of it made me mad. I was fixing to call the dog and go on to school when I heard Grandpa ask Hosey if he had cooties. Hosey would have hit any town boy at school who even mentioned such. I stood there hoping he'd hit Grandpa. Because if he did, that would be the end of that.
"I ain't wanting to shame you, boy," Grandpa said, propping his left elbow on the oak countertop and leaning forward. "I just got to make sure. If and we bring cooties in here, or the 7-year itch, I ain't going to have no customers."
"Yes, sir, I understand, sir," and Hosey turned to leave.
"Wait a minute now, I ain't said I can't hire you, son. But most folks gets the itch now and again, so let me tell you what to do. If and you got it, or if and you get it. Will Tweedy?"
Hosey jerked around. He must not have known I was still there.
"Go in the storeroom, Will, and open up that case of Citicide. Bring me a bottle for Hosey."
Why did he have to say that? Oh, well, let him make Hosey mad. Nothing I'd welcome more than to take on Hosey Roach at recess today.
"You heard about Citicide?" asked Grandpa.
"No, sir."
"Well, it's itch medicine. Use it at night, not when you come into work, 'cause it's the stinkinest stuff you ever come across in your life. Got sulfur in it. Makes the skin yellow and you'll smell like a rotten egg. But by dang, it'll cure the itch. Dr. Lem's shop over in Harmony Grove invented it. Commerce, you know. Dr. Lem ships the stuff all over the United States of America, so it's got to be good."
"Yes, sir." Hope was rising in Hosey's face.
"Now about cooties. I ain't saying you got 'em, but we can't be too careful. What you want to do is get your ma to cut your hair short, short as mine. Wash your head with lye soap every night for a while, and use you one of them fine-tooth combs to get the nits out. You all got one of them combs, boy?"
"No, sir."
Grandpa reached up on the shelf back of him, but the comb box was empty.
"I'll order some from the wholesale house, son. We do a real good business in fine-tooth combs. Lots of town folks got trouble with them critters."
He didn't say the town people with cooties were usually teachers of children who'd caught them at school from lint heads. Hosey bent over to pet T.R., I guess so his red face wouldn't show. Finally, he said,
"Mr. Blakesley, I can start work today. I'm ready and willing, sir."
"No, not today," said Grandpa. "Now you go get squared away at school, son, and get your hair cut and all. Tomorrow will be just fine."
Like I said, Grandpa could get away with anything. And he had finally done what the school superintendent never could. He'd made Hosey Roach willing to quit school. Mama had a fit when Papa told her about Hosey being hired. She said Grandpa was crazy to think town folks would accept a mill boy in the store.
"Well, maybe all can keep him in the back," she decided. "You really got to have some help."
Papa and Cousin Hopewell Stump opened up next morning, but Hosey was there ahead of them. He had found a broom out back and was sweeping the board sidewalk in front of the store when they walked up.
"Lord, Mary Willis, we didn't know who he was," Papa said at dinner. "That boy was bald as a newborn babe."
Hosey hadn't just got his hair cut, he'd shaved his head. I really resented him wanting to please all that bad, especially after Papa asked could I spare an old cap so Hosey wouldn't look so funny. Papa was real impressed with Hosey.
The next week, Miss Love told Grandpa the store ought to have a milliner and offered to teach Loma. She thought Loma might have a real knack for hats. Grandpa didn't exactly promise the job, but he said it sure would be nice if she could earn her keep, which may have been what Miss Love had in mind. Anyhow, it wasn't long before the two of them came down to the store and set up the millinery table again, and Miss Love put a sign in the window saying Mrs. Loma Williams was under her tutelage and was ready to accommodate customers for new Easter hats at a special low price. Loma was in hog heaven being out in public again. I never knew she could act so nice to people. The ladies of Cold Sassy were only too glad to help her get started, knowing Miss Love would lay a hand on every hat, and all the men asked Grandpa how come he waited so long to bring his pretty daughter into the store.
"Just never thought to," said Grandpa, grinning proud and draping his arm around Loma's shoulders. "If and she'd have been a boy, I'd have had her down here from the day she was born."
Loma looked pleased. I hadn't really hated her for a good while, but I hated her right then. I knew if she worked hard, she could worm her way into Grandpa's good graces. And the same with Hosey. Between the two of them, Grandpa might not even notice when I went off to the university. And would the store ever be quite the same, now the two of the people I couldn't stand were there every day?
Chapter 46. I shaved for the first time on my 15th birthday. Went to school with little pieces of paper stuck on my face to stop the bleeding. That was the 30th day of April. Peonies and flag lilies and poppies were blooming in people's yards, and roses and sweet William, mountain laurel and bleeding heart. And boy, howdy, I was 15 years old. Smiley and them gave me 15 licks at recess, one for each year. Then after school they rubbed smut on my face. When I went to the boys' washroom to get it off, I looked in the mirror, and gosh, it was like I'd grown a black beard. What it was, they were jealous of me being the first to shave. I like to have never got the smut off. My face was still streaked when I headed for the store. I was already late, and as I hurried by the Presbyterian church, a girl's voice called from behind a big beauty bush in full bloom.
"Will?" It was Lightfoot. "Will, can you talk a minute?"
She peeped around the beauty bush.
"You got time just for a minute?"
Glancing quickly up and down the street, I ducked around where she was. Gosh, she looked pretty. Her face wasn't pinched from thinness and sorrow like the last time I saw her. The ivory skin glowed against the deep blue of her dress. Like in my dreams, her hair hung loose and shone like platinum.
"Lightfoot?"
I'd thought so many times what I'd say when I finally saw her again, but now I was tongue-tied and embarrassed.
You all right?"
"Yeah, I'm fine. I knowed you nearly always come by here going to the store from school, but I was just fixing to give you up. You must have had to stay in." "No, I just had to wash my face." I rubbed my chin. "Boys put smut on me. It's my birthday today. I'm 15.
"Well, that's nice. I was 15 2 months ago."
Gosh, I hadn't thought about her being older than me.
You getting on all right, Lightfoot?" I asked again. "Pretty good. How you doing, Will?"
"Fine. My grandpa bought a Pierce car and I drive it for him."
"Yeah, I heard."
"You did?"
"Hosey told me."
"Oh. Well, with the weather getting nice, I reckon we gonna be taking trips again soon. Lightfoot, I've been hoping to see you again. I owe you an apology for, you know, in the cemetery that day. I didn't mean to do it.
That's over and done with, Will."
She put her hand on my arm.
"And it's one reason I come. You so nice, I knowed you'd feel bad about that day. I sure was sorry the lady had such a fit at you, but I ain't sorry you wanted to comfort me. Maybe I ought to say it, but I ain't never gonna forget that time with you."
I dared to put my hand on her hand that was on my arm,
and where it had seemed like a million years since I kissed her, all of a sudden it was no more than a day.
Lightfoot, if you ain't mad, why'd you wait so long to say so? Why are you saying it now?
She flushed and pulled away. I just wanted you to know before... She faltered.
How's Miss Nepi? She is real nice to me.
She's fine, but she ain't my teacher now.
You gonna get to come back to school next year?
No,
but I've been studying Hosey's books, Will. I ain't gonna quit Lana no matter what.
School ain't been the same with you not there.
Smiling, she put her hand in her pocket and held out a big buckeye. Would you take it, Will? For luck and to remember me by? I brung it with me from White County when we come down here. I ain't gonna need it no more now.
Something about her tone made me suspicion what this was all about.
Lightfoot, are you saying goodbye to me?
She said, Will, I mostly come to make things right betwixt us whilst I'm still free to. I wanted you to know I never thought hard of you for, you know, and yeah, I reckon that's it. I come to say goodbye.
Where you going? Back to White County?
I thought I couldn't stand it, not ever to see her again.
Will, I'm going to get married.
The sky wobbled.
Get married?
I didn't want you to hear it from nobody else. I'm going to marry Hosey.
Oh, good gosh almighty.
We couldn't even think on it for your granddaddy give him that job. Hosey's got a chance in life now, Will. We'll always feel beholden to Mr. Blakesley. He sure is a fine man. I better go now, but I ain't never going to forget you, and please don't forget me, Will. That's why I give you the buckeye. Look at it every now and again, and remember.
She kissed me quick on the cheek. Her eyes were brimming with tears. Next thing I knew, she had disappeared.
As if a chance in life wasn't enough, the next day Grandpa let Hosey off work early to go over to Jefferson for the license, and even lent him his mule for the trip. Also raised his wages 50 cents a week. It like to killed me. I felt by myself in a way I never had in my life. Miss Love just had eyes for Grandpa, and Grandpa was taken up with her, and now Lightfoot was about to marry Hosey Roach. Maybe something would stop it. Maybe something would happen to Hosey. Maybe...
School was out for the summer on Friday that week, and they got married on Sunday at the Little Baptist Church in Milltown.
We just went up after preaching, Hosey told Grandpa, and got the knot tied.
The one that something happened to was Grandpa.
Chapter 47
Grandpa worked late the following Friday night. Hosey Roach worked late too, naturally, but went home to Lightfoot about 9 o'clock, a good hour before Grandpa locked up to go home to Miss Love. Just as he turned the door key, a man stuck a Harrington and Richardson revolver to the back of his head, and a rough voice said, "Unlock that door, Mr. Blakesley. It ain't quite time to close up yet." There were two of them, one big and burly, the other a younger fellow with a slight build. Despite they had dirty white handkerchiefs over their faces, Grandpa recognized them right off as the strangers who'd come in the store that morning claiming to be cotton buyers. They made him unlock the cash register, despite he said it was empty, and it was empty. Then they sat him down in a straight chair by the pot-bellied stove out of sight from the street and tied him to the chair with a length of median rope cut from the store's big coil. All that time, Grandpa kept saying how poor he was. "I ain't got no more cash money than a one-horse farmer," he insisted. "The store don't bring in enough these days for nobody to bother stealing it."
"Tell that to somebody ain't got no sense," said the big burly one. "A man ain't poor that owns two automobiles and a store and a hotel."
He nodded towards Miss Love's fine cuisine sign in the window.
"Luther, tie that last knot tighter. Now, sir, where's your safe?" "There ain't a dime in that safe," roared Grandpa, struggling against the rope. He was really mad.
As the burly one slapped him across the face, Luther spied the safe.
"Now call out the combination," ordered the big fella. "And if I was you, sir, I wouldn't give no wrong numbers." "Have it your way, but it's a waste of time," Grandpa insisted. "I used to keep cash money in there. but not since I read about somebody breaking in a store in Atlanta and carting off the safe to blow up later. I don't—"
"Say the combination for Luther here," the big fella ordered again. "Say it slow. He ain't too bright."
So Grandpa said the numbers. But Luther, being a little bit drunk and his hands shaking like the palsy from nervousness, he couldn't work it. They decided to untie Grandpa and make him do it. Just like he said, the safe was empty, except for his will and a letter and some stock certificates, land deeds, and other legal papers. The robbers were mad, boy howdy.
"Now, sir, you tell us where that money is or get ready to die one," the big fella yelled, waving his revolver in Grandpa's face.
"I sure didn't waste no time minding them boogers," Grandpa said the next morning when he was telling us all about the robbery. "Gosh almighty, I couldn't hardly wait to upturn my dang nail keg."
He was lying on his left side in Granny's big bed. Miss Love sat in the rocking chair facing him. The rest of us stood behind her, I and Mama and Papa, Aunt Loma, Mary Toy, and Aunt Carrie, who had come over offering to help.
"Well, sir, I dumped the nail keg and..."
Grandpa, trying to turn onto his back, quickly eased back to his left side, which was where the broke ribs were. Doc had bound his chest tight with strips of old sheets to keep the broke ribs from moving every time he breathed.
"It don't hurt so bad as long as I stay like this," he said, his face twisted with pain. "Ain't I a pretty sight, Will Tweedy?" He tried to grin.
I could hardly bear to look at him. Besides a big ugly knot on his forehead, he had two black eyes, his nose was swelled up huge, broke for the fourth time in his life, and Doc had bandaged a bad gash over his left eye. Besides all that, his right knee was bad twisted, and he was sore and bruised all over. My daddy got him back to talking about the highwaymen.
"Did they get all the money, sir?"
"I reckon, Hart. Like I say, I dumped the keg, nails, and all, and besides the day's earnings, out fell all them silver dollars and gold pieces I had in there. Must have been $150 worth, and them coins rolling ever which way."
Grandpa spread his right arm wide to indicate the whole store, but I noticed he was mindful of his broke ribs.
"Gosh almighty, they was greedy. Went down on hands and knees crawling around just to grab 'em. They'd been drinking, you know, and they weren't any too bright, and was new at the game, too, I reckon, 'cause they plumb forgot I wasn't still tied up. All I had to do was watch my chance and whack each one across the back of the neck with the side of my hand. Thonk, thonk. By the time they come to, I was a-settin' on the counter with their dang Harrington and Richardson pointed right at 'em."
Grandpa usually kept his own revolver under the counter, a Smith & Wesson, but had taken it home for cleaning. First he made his prisoners take off their handkerchief masks.
"Why, I thought you all was men," he exclaimed, making like he was surprised. "But dang if you ain't monkeys."
Grandpa was having the time of his life. He said,
"Well, just in case you all got mind to start some monkey business, I'll do a little target practice. See that there cardboard advertisement?"
He nodded toward a cutout of a pretty lady holding a box of Pearline washing compound. It hung by a string from the ceiling just above where the robbers were sitting on the floor, but being dazed and dumbfounded, they looked all around and didn't see what he was talking about.
"It's a-hanging right over y'all's heads," jeered Grandpa.
The men looked up just as he shot the string half in two, dropping the cardboard lady to the floor at their feet.
"Now then, I reckon y'all gonna behave whilst I ring up Pearl Potter, our police. That's Mr. Pearl Potter, for your information."
But with just one hand, Grandpa would have to lay down the revolver to talk on the phone. Not being that big of a fool, he told Luther to do the calling.
"Say to Mr. Pearl, me and my buddy been trying to rob Mr. Blakesley's store, so come get us and put us in the calaboose. Make haste now, Luther. I got to get on home. Gosh almighty, I'll bet Mr. Pearl ain't never got a call like this'n before," he said, laughing.
Luther stood up real slow, eyeing the telephone.
"You ain't never seen a telephone?"
Grandpa was trying to goad him.
"All you do, you turn that crank, then you pick up that doohickey and put it up to your ear and wait till Central answers. What you talk through is that thang sticking out of the box. Tell her Rucker Blakesley is a-holding you and your partner, and you want to speak to Mr. Pearl Potter."
The robber was naturally mad as heck, being made fun of like that, but he did like he was told to, then just stood there and stood there.
"Why ain't you talking?" asked Grandpa.
"'Cause she don't answer," said Luther.
"Dang," said Grandpa.
Miss Lucille must have gone to the bathroom. Crank it again, sonny boy.
All of a sudden he noticed that the other fellow, the burly one, had stood up and moved a step forward.
You want a bullet through that mole on your chin, buster? He yelled, waving the revolver. Move one more step and I'll put it there. Or maybe you'd rather watch me shoot another string half in two.
He saw the men exchange quick glances when he said that, but as he himself admitted later, he was having such a good time he never thought nothing of it. Instead of stepping back, the big hunky fella sneered and said, "That with the string was just a lucky shot. You can't do it again."
"Lessen your revolver don't aim true. I can do it any number of times."
Still sitting on the counter, not taking his eyes off the big fella, Grandpa said, "Keep on cranking that phone, Luther."
"A gun can't shoot no better than the fella aiming it," said the big hunky one and eased forward a little.
Grandpa saw that.
"Go to dancing, buster," he yelled, firing off a bullet that grazed the toe of the man's boot.
Even before he pulled the trigger again and got a click instead of a bang, young Luther dropped the receiver, leaving it dangling by the cord. Crouching low like a bobcat ready to spring, he grabbed Grandpa's right knee, turned quick, and jerked him off the counter just as his partner raised a chair high and crashed it over Grandpa's head.
Chapter 48.
We all wondered if the robbers meant to kill Grandpa.
"He sure looked dead when I come in the store," said Mr. Pearl. "Out cold and bleeding like a hog."
Dr. Slaughter said it was just a good thing Miss Lucille got back to her switchboard in time to plug into the fight, and then had the good sense to ring up him and Mr. Pearl. If Miss Lovett had a telephone, she would have been called next instead of us. As it was, she just started wondering why Grandpa hadn't come on home when she heard Mr. Birdsong's old horse-drawn hearse rattle into her drive, the one he took Uncle Cam to the morgue in, but called an ambulance if the person wasn't dead yet. Miss Love didn't have any way to know for sure which it was when Doc climbed out and said he'd brought Rucker home. Papa and I got there in the Cadillac a minute or two later. I won't ever forget the look on Miss Love's face as she watched us bring Grandpa in on the stretcher. You'd think he'd been under a rock all his life, he was so pale. The knot on his forehead was big as a double yolk egg. The gash over his left eye was still bleeding, and his face was a twist of pain. But as we carried him towards the bedroom, Miss Love holding a lamp high to light our way down the hall, Grandpa looked up at her with a weak grin and said, "Don't worry, here. I'll be up in the morning before the water boils. I got outsmarted, is all." Then he coughed and yelped with pain from the broke ribs. Before I got inside his house good on Saturday night after it happened on Friday night, Grandpa called from the sick room, "That you, Will Tweedy? Anything new happened down at the store? They catch them robbers? Come in here, son." His room smelled of turpentine, which Doc had prescribed as a liniment for the pulled ligament. Grandpa was sitting on the side of the bed in his nightshirt, holding a pack of steaming hot towels to his knee. By then he was tired of hurting and maddering heck at the robbers. "If and I ever meet up with them two again," he yelled, shaking his fist, "I'll kill them." "Better wait till you feel better, Grandpa," I said, joking. That just made him madder. But he had to get a hold of himself because the ranting and raving made his ribs hurt. Groaning, he eased back down on the bed, turning onto his left side. "It ain't so bad, long as I lay still and breathe shallow."
"Dr. Slaughter says you must breathe deep," Miss Love reminded him, coming in with a supper tray.
"Gosh almighty, woman, I'd like to see him breathe deep in my condition. All this wouldn't have happened, Will Tweedy, if and I'd just knowed what them dang robbers knowed. That one put two bullets in their dang revolver."
Miss Love set the tray on a towel on the bed so Grandpa could eat laying on his side.
"You couldn't have known about the bullets," she said, patting his shoulder.
"Don't pat me when I'm mad, woman. I would have knowed about them bullets if I'd have looked."
He groaned, reaching down to rub his knee.
"And I would have looked," he added, "if and I hadn't have been talking so big and showing off."
"Dear, try to stay calm. Dr. Slaughter said..."
"Let Doc stay calm. I'm mad and hurting, and I need to get on to the store."
Grandpa took a bite of cornbread and kept right on fussing.
"If and they'd have fought fair with fists, I could have licked them boogers, either one or both of them."
He wasn't just mad, he was embarrassed. What hurt most, worse than the broke ribs, broke nose, banged head, and twisted knee all put together, was his pride. The only fight he'd ever lost before was the war between the states. Miss Love bent over him and touched his cheek.
"You're alive," she whispered. "That's all I care about."
"Well, it ain't all I care about. Doggett, no damn it, by gosh. I never thought to get done in by a dang setting chair. If I'd have seen it coming, I could have ducked." He groaned.
My mother was coming down the hall as I left Grandpa's room to hurry back to the Saturday night customers at the store. "I thought maybe I could help some way," she told Miss Love. "Maybe wash your supper dishes, and I'll take the soiled sheets home for Queenie to wash and iron."
Almost timidly, she peered in at Grandpa lying in the bed.
"Pa," she said sweetly, "would you like me to come sit with you a few minutes?"
He was still mad at the robbers. "I reckon, Mary Willis," he grumped, "effin' you'll sit over in the corner, not say nothing and not cry. I can't stand it when you mother hen me."
I just knew she'd burst into tears. Instead, she snapped back at him like she'd been taking lessons from Aunt Loma. "Just 'cause you didn't get your way with the robbers is no reason to talk to me like that, Pa, and I don't have to stay and listen to it."
She turned to stalk out. "Oh, Mary Willis, honey, come on in here and sit down." Motioning toward the rocking chair, he grinned up at her. "Did you bring me a snort by any chance? Miss Love ain't no different from your ma when it comes to whiskey in the closet."
Mom actually burst out laughing. "I did too, and so did Miss Love."
Grandpa almost laughed, but had to keep it to a smirk. Laughing hurt his ribs. I knew Mama had come mostly to be with her daddy. Miss Love was not one she had in mind when she said what families are for is to help in time of trouble. But Miss Love seemed real glad to have her there. I didn't get back again till after dinner Sunday. By then the whole house smelled like turpentine. Thinking Grandpa might be asleep, I tiptoed down the hall instead of calling out. Just as I was about to peep into his room, I heard him and Miss Love talking soft and easy in there, the way people do when they're resting and in no hurry. I knew I ought to announce my presence, but instead, drawn back behind the open door, I looked at them through the slit between it and the doorframe. I could see them easy. Miss Love, in a pretty yellow dress, was lying atop the sheet on Granny's side of the bed, her head cradled in the crook of Grandpa's left elbow. He lay on his left side, a thin nightshirt over the tight binding around his chest, the sheet pulled up to his waist. And gosh, he had his right arm laid across Miss Love's stomach. His eyes were closed. To save me, I couldn't move or speak.
"Are you about to go to sleep, Rucker?" she asked softly.
He said, "No, I'm just looking at the inside of my eyelids."
"What?"
"I got my eyes shut, and I'm a-looking, which ain't the same as just having your eyes closed. Did you know you can shut your eyes and see in the dark? At night it's like looking at a moldy old prune, just all kinds of gray dots and lines and curlicues amidst the blackness."
Turning his face towards the window, which was a block of bright sunshine, he exclaimed, "But gosh almighty, Love, honey, it's so much more to look at now. It's like watching a dang sunset. Mostly red and orange, but they streaks of brown, too, and a big purple blob that moves, and here come some little green dots."
"What on earth are you talking about?"
Miss Love thought Grandpa was joking. I did, too. I near about laughed out loud.
His eyes still closed, he grinned. "Shut your eyes and look. You'll see."
Miss Love did what she was told, turning her head towards the window as her black lashes brushed her freckled cheeks. I shut my eyes, too. In order to see the sunshine, I held my face up close to the crack in the door.
"I see what you mean," she exclaimed. "Why, it's beautiful, Rucker. I never noticed before. Goodness, it would make a lovely design for dress goods, but what's the point?"
"Ain't no point. Just something to do when you can't sleep. Leastways, that's how I got onto it last night. When I went to looking and marveling how much I could see in the dark, I quit thinking words, and then I started to get sleepy. The surprise was when God came into the picture. I don't mean I saw God. I felt him, like he was inside of me, or at least closer than my nose, instead of being way off up in the clouds somewhere that I can't reach to."
His voice softened.
"It feels like that now, Love. It must be what the Bible means by peace be still, or be still and know that I am God."
For a while, neither one said anything. Then Miss Love asked, "Are you praying now, Rucker?"
"No'm,"
Like I say, I'm just a-staring at my eyelids. If and I went to praying, I'd be saying words, thinking about myself and what I want, what I'm scared of. This way, I ain't thinking nothing. I'm just feeling God's presence. It makes me feel safe, like I can do anything I got to, including stand all this dang pain. I reckon it sounds like foolishment. You probably think I'm off in the head, love, like them folks that has visions.
No, she said softly, because I feel it too.
Don't it seem like your brain ain't cluttered up? Like if and the Lord wanted to tell you something, you'd know what it was.
Yes, it feels like that, she murmured.
A covey of goosebumps thrilled up the backs of my arms because it felt like that to me too. Well, let's say amen now. I'm through looking at my eyelids. I'd rather look at you a while.
Opening my own eyes, I saw Miss Love smile, and him smile back, so tender. They lay there a few minutes, neither one speaking. Then, rubbing his whiskers, he said, "Is this Sunday?" She nodded.
"Then I ain't shaved in nearly 3 days. It's got so I can't stand whiskers, love."
He grinned at her.
"See what you done? I used to didn't care."
Another silence, and he said, "You miss going to the Methodist church, don't you?" She hesitated. "Sometimes. Well, every Sunday. It's the way I was brought up."
"You miss that collection plate going around, and Miss Effie Bell plowing up and down the piano, and all them dull announcements, not to mention them dull sermons?"
"I wouldn't swap one of your sermons to have all that." She laughed, then got serious. "But I like being part of a congregation. I miss the people, Rucker."
"All them dang hypocrites?"
"My mother always said, never expect church members to be perfect. Christians are still people."
"Well, she spoke the truth there."
"Most of us Christians need to go to church, Rucker. By ourselves, we feel uneasy about God, and we're too bashful to pray except when we're sick or scared. We read our Bibles, but we never think things out the way you do. But you, it's a wonder God didn't call you to preach, Rucker."
"Ain't I been preaching to you?"
"I mean in a church. I mean really preach." She smiled at him so sweet. "I was getting restless. I wanted to leave. But a board creaked the first step I took, so I decided to wait a little. It being Sunday, they'd probably go on to sleep. Long as I could remember, Mama and Papa had gone to their room every Sunday after dinner and shut the door, and we knew better than to wake them up."
"I got called to preach one time," said Grandpa, "up in the mountains when I was a peddlin'." He laughed. "But it warn't the Lord that called me. I done the callin'. Called myself Brother Blakesley, itinerant Baptist preacher and peddler of fine merchandise."
"Oh, you didn't." Grinning, she raised up on her elbow to look at him. "Why in the—"
"I'd just come out of the war. I'd had my fill of sleeping in the woods and cooking over a dang campfire. I reasoned that them mountain folks would feed a preacher and put him up, and then buy his blankets and needles to help with the Lord's work. Well, it sure did backfire. I got me an invite to preach, but I warned into my sermon hardly when a mean-eyed man on the front row stood up and cussed me out. Said I must be the devil incarnate, or at least his agent, 'cause I sure want no true believer. Amens rose up all over that little room."
"Goodness, what did you do?"
"Thought fast, I tell you. 'Wait a minute, folks,' I shouted. 'All what I just said, that was supposed to be the devil a-talking. Now if y'all will shut up, I'll tell you what God said back to that old fork-tail varmint.' I wasn't going to let a bunch of dang hill people run me off. I went at it, making up stories about sinners that God had punished and spouting hellfire and damnation and all the other preacher stuff I could think of."
He grinned.
"Didn't make a dang bit of sense, but they liked it. Wanted me back next Sunday. But I'd learnt my lesson, love. I vowed it was the last time I'd try to tell about my Jesus and my God to folks with rock minds."
He blew at a curl near her ear. She shivered, giggled. "Quit. That tickles."
"You rather me preach?
I wished I felt up to having our Sunday time in the parlor. I got a good sermon worked out for you." "Well, I could go play some hymns." "Oh, my gosh, where could I hide right quick?"
"Not now, love,"
said Grandpa. "I'd rather have you laying here by me. You help me forget the pain, and I don't feel so sick." Another silence.
"What's it about?"
She sounded lazy, sleepy. "The sermon, I mean." "Something Will Tweedy's been questioning. He don't understand why Jesus said, 'Ask and it shall be given.' He says, why would Jesus say such a thing when it ain't always so?" "That's easy to explain, Rucker. Tell Will that sometimes God has to say no for our own good, or to teach us something, or show his power. Sometimes it's just not his will to give us a certain thing, or he wants to test our faith and see if we trust him no matter what." Grandpa laughed. "Love, you sound like every preacher I ever heard. But Jesus didn't say God might say no when we say gimme. He said God's gonna say yes,